And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm delighted to welcome Vince Vaughter back to the program today. Vince has over 40 years' experience in the newspaper industry. In 2013, he published his first autobiographically inspired novel, Paperboy, which was widely acclaimed and won a Newbery Honor. Today we'll be talking about its sequel, Copyboy, which is published by Capstone. His protagonist, Victor Vollmer, has a stutter, much like he himself has. In order to honor Vince's and Victor's situation, I won't be editing our conversation as I normally do. You'll hear Vince in his true voice, and you'll hear me in mine. And now, my interview with Vince Vaughter. Vince, how long has passed since the end of Paperboy and the beginning of Copyboy?
It's been almost exactly 5 years.
And so we're now in 1965?
You're exactly right, yes.
So what was Memphis like in 1965?
Well, it was a great place. It was a place where you still could ride your bike around. There was not anywhere you really couldn't go when you were in the city. And it was a friendly city. It really was. It was just a comfortable place.
Now, a lot of things have changed in these 5 years in between for Victor.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is his family has moved out east.
Correct.
And this is pretty much like as far east as you could go and still be in the city, right?
Well, it was actually close to Audubon golf course, and so it wasn't too far out. Well, it seemed like a long way then. I mean, it was way out in East Memphis then.
Yeah, had they even finished 240 at that time?
Oh, no. Mm-mm.
Now, he's gotten a job
right
in the newspaper business, but not throwing papers.
Right.
He's actually working for the Press Scimitar down in their offices.
Right. He's a copy boy. And I've been asked a lot what a copy boy is. Unfortunately, we don't have many copy boys now. It's kind of a job that went away when computers came into the business. A copy boy, though, he or she had truly hundreds of duties, changing typewriter ribbons, running galley proofs, page proofs, tearing wire copy. It was just a lot of jobs. And, of course, with computers, all the pneumatic tubes are gone. The teletype machines are gone now, and so you really don't have copy boys anymore.
And Victor's a go-getter, so he was actually doing extra, like cleaning the actual typeface on the typewriters, the keys, the strokes themselves.
He was kind of in love with typewriters. He thought of a typewriter as kind of his closest friend, and the reason he did that was he could make words come out of the end of his fingers when he couldn't say the words. He had a severe speech impediment, much like I did. I had trouble saying my own name. I couldn't tell you my phone number. Yet I could type them, and so a typewriter, it was a good friend.
Now, why did Victor start typing books, actually copying them by typing them?
Right. Well, I can tell you why I started doing that. There was a certain calmness that came when I could see words go down on paper that came out of my own thought processes. And so if I found a passage I liked, I would just start typing it. And it seemed to soothe me. It really did. I think in the book a copy boy. I think I said I typed The Old Man and the Sea two times. I don't think I really did that. All in all, though, I probably typed the whole book at one time or another. It's a short book, and so it didn't take all that long. And I just liked the way that he put his words together. It seemed natural. I think I have an analogy in the book, like if you tried to pull one word from a Hemingway story, it seemed like the whole thing would collapse. There were no extraneous words. It was a pleasure to read and a pleasure to type it.
I'm sure typing those concise Hemingway sentences were influential on when he started writing headlines for himself to see if he could predict what a headline might be.
I think you're exactly right. I did. I started reading Hemingway when I was 12 years old. I didn't know who he was really at that point. But I can remember the day in 1961 when I picked the paper up and I saw he had killed himself. And I felt like I had lost a friend. I didn't know much about his life at that point. I just knew I liked the way that he wrote.
Do you think typing that book out gave you a little bit more insight into the writing process and how to structure things?
Well, I'm not sure it did. The reason I think I typed it was probably a form of self-therapy. And so I don't know that I was paying attention to a sentence, a structure, or anything like that. It was just a soothing. I could type all night if I wanted to. I didn't have to talk to anybody, and it was a true pleasure just to type the words and to see how they were put together.
Now, in your many years in the newspaper business, mm-hmm. and writing in a very particular journalistic style, often it's the inverted pyramid, they call it.
Right.
When you started writing fiction, were there different gears you had to start changing to?
It was a wholesale change of gears. It really was. I think a lot of writers like to say, and it's an old bromide, that in journalism you tell and don't show. And in fiction, you show and you don't tell. Well, I never really understood that until I started writing fiction. And that is exactly right. If you start just telling things, it's very boring. I don't think anybody would want to read it. It's just boring. It's kind of like homework or something. But if you show things that are important to the narrative storyline, if you show it and don't tell it, it gets much more interesting. And so I had to back up. And like in Paperboy, I probably wrote 200,000 words just to get my 50,000 words. And the words I threw away, it was telling. It was not showing. So if you hear a writer say, show and don't tell, there is something really to that. It's kind of hard to explain, though. It really is. You've just got to try to feel it, really.
Now, did writing for the papers, and you have to write in an accessible style that people with a lot of different educational backgrounds could understand, did that help you in writing books that are aimed at a lot of different audiences?
Sure. I think in the newspaper business, the rule of thumb, it used to be that you needed to write for a 10th grade education. And I think that's – and, you know – that's what we did. And so I found out it's about the only way I can write. You know, I know some pretty fancy words now. But they just don't seem to fit with my writing style. I think it was Hemingway that said you should never use a 50-cent word when a nickel word would do. And I think that's exactly right.
Anglo-Saxon over Latinate.
Yeah.
Now, there's another writer that's referenced in the book, and that's Nietzsche.
Right.
And I can't think of a writer who's much more different from Hemingway than Nietzsche.
True. The reason that he's in there is I wanted the copy boy to be stretched a little bit. And I did the same thing in Paperboy. There was Heidegger in Paperboy, and there was Voltaire in Paperboy. And so I wanted to I wanted something that would kind of make the protagonist kind of reach a little bit, and so that's why he's in there.
Now, the Memphis Press-Imitator was an afternoon paper.
Correct.
Which means the working day starts really early.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Yeah. For about 10 years, I started at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And it's hard to get used to, but once you get used to it, you can get a lot done. Because you're through at noon. And if you can make it without a nap, you get the whole afternoon to, you know, play golf or read or whatever you want to do. And then you got to go to bed at 8 o'clock. But, you know, you're ready to go to bed if you've gotten up at 3 o'clock in the morning. So that's how I write now. I start all my writing days at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And I'm done by probably 9 o'clock. That's about all I can stand. I find it's the most productive then, and I really enjoy getting up so early in the morning. It's a special time.
No phones ringing.
No phones ringing, right?
No salesman coming to the door.
Right. No political phone calls on there.
Now, when Victor and his family moved out east. Mm-hmm. Ma'am,
right.
Who was the housekeeper, mm-hmm. didn't come with him.
She didn't move with him, and she didn't move with me. That was very difficult. And for that reason, I didn't like our new house in East Memphis. I didn't like it because Ma'am wasn't there. And, you know, it was a nice modern house. It had central air conditioning of all things. You know, it had a central vacuum cleaner. I mean, you know, it was a nice house. I did not like that house, though, because I didn't have my friend Ma'am. She had moved back to Coldwater, Mississippi. And so it was a great loss. It really was.
And in that neighborhood, bigger lots, things are more spread out.
Right.
It's harder to get from place to place.
Exactly right. Right. Yeah.
Now, Victor has always had a little bit more problem talking with his mother than he has his father.
Right.
And it seems like his mother has a little bit of resentment toward his father for being able to connect with him.
I think that's right. There was always, and I want to be careful how I say this, there was always an undercurrent in my parents' marriage. And I didn't know what it was exactly, but I knew that something wasn't right. And I was always mindful of that. And I watched carefully how they would interact with each other and then with me. My father traveled a lot. He was gone all the time. And so it was my mother who really raised me. And I don't want to say I love my father more than my mother. That's not correct. But it seemed like I had more in common with my father in the way I thought about things. And I always thought that he was my biological father. It turned out that was not the case. But at the time that Paperboy was going on, I had no idea that he was not my biological father.
And that's a biographical detail that you put in the story for Victor as well.
Right.
And you do mine a lot of your biography for details in the story.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the most important parts of Paperboy, Mr. Spiro, was a creation of yours.
Yes. He is the only character in the book who is not a, quote, real person. I kind of had to make him up just to pull everything together in the book. I had to. He was the glue that kind of held everything together. It's funny working with Random House. I had to go through with them and tell them which character was a real person, which wasn't. I guess for legal reasons, I had to do that. So I came to Mr. Spiro, and I said, "Oh, he's completely fiction." And my editor looked at me and she said, "I know who Mr. Spiro is." And I said, "You do?" And she said, "Yeah, he's you at 60 years old. That's who Mr. Spiro is." And I started thinking about that. And as it turns out, I think that she was exactly right. He was the mentor whom I always wish I had. And I didn't have him. So that was a kind of a cathartic moment in this, realizing that I guess Mr. Spiro was me.
But in a way, you've committed a literary suicide because Mr. Spiro has died in the interim.
Right. It's funny, though. There is probably more of Mr. Spiro in Copy Boy, even though he died, I think there's more of him in there, and I think that's as it should be. If I can tell a quick story about how Copy Boy really came to be. I told my agent, I told my editor, I told my publisher, I was not going to write a sequel to Paperboy, because the book, it turned out exactly like I envisioned it. I said everything I wanted to. I didn't need to say any more. And then, you know, it went on to win the Newbery honor. It went on to be published in 8 foreign languages, and so I was completely satisfied. I was down in Sarasota, Florida, speaking at a school, and I spoke to a general assembly of a few grades, the 7th through the 9th grade, I think. And then I had a lunch with a few of the students who seemed to be invested in the book. And so I was eating lunch, and this young lady, I guess in the 8th or 9th grade, came up to me, and she said, "I want to know what happened to Mr. Spiro." And I said, "Well, as I told you earlier, I can tell you what happened to ma'am. I can tell you what happened to RIT. I can tell you what happened to everybody except Mr. Spiro, because he was fiction." And I saw a tear coming down her cheek. And she said, "I know that, Mr. Valder. You made him up once, and so you can make him up again." And at that point, I just, well, you know, I felt a stab in my heart. And then I went home and I started reading all the emails that I had gotten, you know, over the past 2.5 years. And a lot of them had questions about this, about Mrs. Spiro, about ma'am. You know, where did ma'am go? Did she go with you? What did the 4 words mean? And I just said, well, I've got to try to do something, but I'm going to skip 6 years, and I'm going to show how the paper boy has grown, how he has matured. He still has his speech problem, but you know, some things have changed. You know, and so I want to show that growth, and so I just jumped into it. I tell my agent. I didn't tell my publisher. I didn't tell anybody. I just jumped into it, and it took me about 1.5 years, which is a lot quicker than Paperboy, which took me 5 years. And so I was proud of what I'd done, of what I had done. So I showed it to my agent, and she showed it to my publisher at the time, which was Random House. And they said, "Well, we've got a problem. We don't let our authors change markets. If you're a middle grade writer, you have to stay a middle grade writer. And so if you can rewrite this, and if the protagonist can be 11 or 12 years old, you know, we'll probably publish it." And I just said, "I can't do that. I have got to show how the boy has grown. I've got to grow him with my readers." And they said, "Well, I'm sorry, that's not the way it works. And I said, well, I'm sorry. It's the only way I can make it work. And so we found a new publisher. And they were fine with that, quote, change in market. It goes to what I've said all along. I don't write for age groups. I try to tell good, solid stories that everybody can read. Young or old. And I have never thought, when I wrote Paperboy, you know, I didn't know what middle grade was. I mean, I thought there was young adult fiction and then there was adult fiction. You know, I didn't know there was a middle grade. And I didn't write it for a certain age. I want my books to be accessible for all ages. And I think the books can be read on several different levels. I think a young person, I think that they can get something out of my books, and I think an older person can. I think if you say, okay, I'm going to write a children's book, I think you automatically start writing down to your audience. And the first thing, I think they can smell that a mile away. I think they're turned off by it. And so all I want to do is just try and tell good, solid stories that have some meat in them, and that will last a while. And that's what I'm all about. I don't write for markets.
Now, when Mr. Spiro passed away, mm-hmm. he left a last request mm-hmm. for Victor.
Right.
And it's a big ask.
Yes, it is. The copy boy, though, he's very naive. He thinks it's kind of simple. All I have to do is go down south and find the mouth of the Mississippi River. And there I'll spread Mr. Spiro's ashes. You know, it's kind of simple if you think of it like that. But where is the mouth of the Mississippi River? If you ask a fisherman, he's going to say it's one place. If you ask a Coast Guardsman, he's going to say it's another place.
How long is a piece of string?
Right. That's exactly right. So where is the mouth of the Mississippi River? And that's what the story is about. And if I say too much more, I'll start giving it away. So I don't want to give it away completely. But that's what I think gives the story some meat. Yes, you may have some destination in mind, but you know, think about your journey first. So,
and for younger readers from today, mm-hmm. they don't understand that the world was very different 50 years ago. No GPS, no Google, no cell phones.
Well, I am so excited that Capstone, the publisher, I really wanted to put old maps of the Mississippi Delta on the end sheets of the book. And in publishing, that's a quite expensive process. And I pleaded with them, please, if you would put maps of the Mississippi Delta on the end sheets. It will mean a lot to me, and it should mean a lot to the readers. And so they did that, and I couldn't be more excited. I think the copy boy in one segment, he says the map that I have moved 1 inch on is the fiction of this story. The 3 or 4 hours it took me to move that 1 inch on the map, that's the nonfiction of the story. It's the same story, though. So there's some map play on words through the book. And I think it'll be interesting for teachers who if they can find a road map or some kind of a map, to get a map out and show their students. I think it'll be a very teachable book.
Well, and the Mississippi River is famous for changing course all along its way. So what does the southern bit of Louisiana look like and the river's course look like down there as compared to 50 years ago?
I'm so glad you asked that. The last time that I was in that part of the country was in 1965. My wife and I went back in January of 2017, and it was not the same place. It was completely different. Yet, the feel of it was there. Due to climate change, due to canal building, due to the growth of the country, there is a part of Louisiana which is lost every hour that's the size of a football field. So we are losing a southern Louisiana. It's happening every day. And it's just a wonderful part of the world, and it's going to be gone someday. You know, I don't know how long New Orleans is going to last. That wonderful city. I don't think it's got a lot of years left. Something is going to have to change.
Speaking of New Orleans, who's the general?
The general is based on probably 3 or 4 people I knew in the newspaper business. And he's a compilation of people, and he's a typical newspaper person. He thinks he's smarter than anybody else. He doesn't like to work too hard, but yet he's got a view of the world which is very refreshing, I think. Newspaper people, my friends who I worked with at the Press Cemeter, they will recognize a lot of people in the story because they're some newsroom characters, and it's pretty obvious who they're based on, I think. So I'm going to be talking with them soon after they read the book, and I'm going to be very curious what they think of my characters who are based on real people.
Going back to you having not visited Venice, Louisiana area in 50 years. I guess that was, in a way, a blessing that you didn't have intervening years to cloud your memory and confuse just the precise detail of what you had in mind.
I thought about going down there when I started writing the book, and I didn't go on purpose. I wanted my 1965 self to recall the place, and that's one of the good moves I've made. 'Cause I was shocked when I went down there just to see. Well, there's Highway 23, which goes all the way to Venice. Highway 23 is maybe 10 miles shorter. There are parts of Highway 23 which you can see the Gulf on both sides, and that was not the case in a 65. It's not as crowded as it used to be, just because I think a lot of folks realize that this part of Louisiana is not going to be with us a whole lot longer, and so all the buildings are on stilts. About the only thing that is really new is a bunch of helicopters are down there, which are working the oil refineries. That's new, but it's completely different. And I'm sorry to say that the people down there are not true South Louisianians. They kind of come from all over now, so you don't have that real Cajun Creole kind of a feel down there anymore. There's still a few down there, and I love the way they talk. I just can't get enough of that. It was a special. In 65, to hear it was like a foreign language almost, you know, to hear them talk. Yet you could understand them, but the Cajun way of life, the Cajun language is, you know, is just about gone now.
Could you give us a little flavor and say sure like they did at the end of their sentences?
Yeah. I was reading a sentence here the other day. Let me see if I could get it here. Okay. I'm talking to Phil. She's a Cajun. A girl, a free spirit. And so I say to her, how can you walk on crushed shells and gravel without any shoes? And she says, I've been doing it going on 19 years. If you do anything long enough, you get to where it don't bother you none. Not stuttering, I said. I thought my response would throw her off and get us back to where we were before I asked her about going to college. She didn't flinch. Why you worry so much about how you talk? You in South Louisiana, where all the body talk funny, sure. She could turn on her accent on and off for emphasis. I don't hear you stutter anyhow. so much that you just kind of sputter sometimes. So the Cajuns have a way of putting a kind of an exclamation mark at the end of all their sentences. And that might be the word sure or something like that. It's just a unique patois that is just enchanting, I think.
Well, in other parts of the South, we'd say something like, "I tell you what," at the end of a sentence.
Right. And yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's the same thing. I think with Cajuns, though, it's just unique, and it's so much fun to hear them up talk.
Now, you mentioned Phil. She's part of the Moreau family that Victor's been sent down toward.
Right.
And can you give us a little overview of the Moreau family?
Well, she's 19 years old. Her father is what's known as a river pilot. He used to board ships as they would come into the river, and he would be the captain of the ship up through the river. That is still a law to this day with GPS and everything. If you bring an international ship into the Mississippi River Channel, you have got to have a pilot come aboard and take that ship upriver. It's the law. He has retired now, and he's a commercial fisherman. Phil is his daughter, and she is a free spirit. And the copy boy has never met anybody like her. And he's intrigued by her. She chases swamp rabbits. She'll drink a beer. She'll drink several beers. She's a Cajun two-step dancer. She's just completely full of life, and she takes chances. And this is completely unlike the copy boy, who is naive. He's never been many places. He's a little on the shy side. He's very reserved, and so I think the way that they connect is a kind of an interesting story. It's not really, well, I guess it is a kind of a first romance story. I wouldn't really call it a love story, except it has its moments. It's probably about as much of a love story as a copy boy can stand at this point.
Well, we're going to leave the rest of the story to the readers to get there and all the excitement that follows. Now, you said after Paperboy, you thought you had done the story completely, didn't want to write a sequel, but you feel that same way now, or are you more open?
I say in the Q&A in the back of the book, if I've learned one thing about writing, it's never to say never again. So I don't know. I truly don't know. A story has to come and get me, though. I don't go out looking for stories. They have to come and find me. And so if one finds me, I may do something else. I'm just going to say I really don't know.
Has another one gotten to you yet?
No. Although I've woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning on a few occasions and said, "What if?" But that's as far as it's gone.
Well, Vince, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing the Copy Boy with us.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been a pleasure.
Vince Vaughter is the author of Copy Boy, which is published by Capstone. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.